Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with pianist, composer, recording artist, and educator Josh Nelson. From the land of sunshine and beautiful people in Southern California, Josh is busy promoting his latest album called Exploring Mars, and it's impressive. And he is doing this with a brilliant and inventive multimedia presentation. Over the course of our conversation, we talked about his music-rich upbringing, how he landed on the piano, his training, traveling with Natalie Cole, and what the future may hold for him, along with much more. Dig it, my friends.
Yeah, hey, Josh.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Hey, good, man. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for calling, man.
Oh, yeah, man. I love your music. Thank you for taking all the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, man.
Let's start off at the top here. Let's find out what has been going on with you lately.
Well, Exploring Mars, the latest record, is still on my mind and in the forefront. It's in collaboration with this other project I have called Discovery Project, which is video, live video, and an art installation that accompanies it with the performances of the music. And my previous record, Discoveries, and Exploring Mars are both in this Discovery Project, featured as a video, kind of multimedia presentation. So I have a booking agency that I recently hooked up with. It's trying to get me out of California and to the East Coast and Midwest. And up, I've done a few dates up north in Seattle and San Francisco, but trying to branch out with that. And so it's both the record performance, you know, or a combination of different material from different records and the video. So there's some fun different things that we do with that, you know, and there's some educational outreach that's involved. And yeah, so that's going on. That's what's going on with the record right now.
You can't help but realize that this whole thing is fun. So this album, Exploring Mars, talk to me a little bit about this. How did you incorporate the art, the multimedia, your talk about education? How did it become kind of a full ball of wax and the whole level of impromptu jazz?
I guess I'll go back to Discoveries from 2011. I wanted to make a record themed with some of my favorite literary and science concepts and visionaries. So that record was, I started writing music to the works of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, Nikola Tesla, and others. And then as I was writing it, I realized I thought we could do something with film. Because Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, particularly some early ephemeral films from the early part of the 20th century, at the same time, believe it or not, that movie Hugo was coming out. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
But it was like, I'm like, oh my God, I'm doing this. Like, this is exactly what I was doing at the time that came out. And they were doing all those George Millay Trip to the Moon, you know, stuff, footage. And so we built a show with this videographer who found all these great, a lot of them public domain, archival montage clips and started building video with the music, and then started building music with the video and going back and forth and saying, okay, well, we can improvise the video. I can rescore some things as if they're like a black and white silent film. So it just took on this collaborative effort with this videographer. And then a couple artists started getting involved, and there became this installation idea that in different venues, we installed different video projection screens or light bulb arrays or something to immerse the audience in music, but not only sonically, but visually. So they're having this whole experience of the world, kind of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, Tesla. And then for Mars, we just shifted these subject matter to, of course, Mars, which involves all the rovers and the science they're doing and all the great NASA JPL videos that are, you know, up on their website that are free for the public because we paid for them. We use them in our show. And then some literary tips of the hat, of course, to Ray Bradbury on the record. And I read that same passage live when the band plays. We do it live that same way, like on the record. Yeah, and then the Holst piece, the Gustav Holst Mars Bringer Award, a little tough to do live because when I did it in the studio, it was kind of like a Bill Evans, conversations with myself overdub situation. So I've tried doing it live a couple times where I play along with it, and it's like this last one we did a couple weeks ago is like not happening. It's one of those pieces that just kind of exists in the studio form that it I realized that it is. Which is cool. But anyway, so another reference to Mars there. And the love song, How You Love Me on Mars, that we wrote for the record, and it's all in there. So now we have Discovery Project. So basically I'm looking for material all the time to add or to do new, another record, or I'll write a tune for someone I love, like an actor. I wrote a tune for Peter Sellers called Peter Sellers, which who I love very much.
Yeah.
And we pulled a bunch of Peter Sellers clips and perform them live. And so there's that. Yeah, that's kind of the evolution of it. A collaborative effort, really, with different artists. It started with Discoveries, and it's just continued on through Exploring Mars.
Very cool, man. I love the whole
Thank you.
kind of
Oh, man. Thanks,
multimedia
Joe.
approach. It's very, it reminds me, I don't know if you've seen Fred Hirsch did a thing called Coma Dreams.
Yes,
And
I saw it.
it's kind of that whole performance. I think it's kind of a cool encapsulation. One thing I want to ask you too is, have you ever heard of this guy named Dennis Hope that has claimed kind of ownership over the solar system?
Who? Dennis Ho?
His name is Dennis Hope, and what he's done is he faxed the Nixon administration for years because a country cannot own anything in outer space. And in a hokey way, he got a hold of basically, they didn't say specifically, but they said, go ahead and pursue it. So he sells deeds to like the moon and Mars and all these places. When you get a chance, you should Google and just look at this dude because he sells these kind of bogus fun deeds to people for like $20 and they get like a parcel of land on either the moon or Mars. So,
Wow, you know what that reminds me of?
what's that?
International Star Registry.
Yes, it's the exact concept, but he's making a lot more money off of it. He knows what he's doing, but he's claiming it's all real deal. He's giving you kind of hectometers on the moon and where it's at geographically. So if things go bad down here, you hop on a ship with Richard Branson and get your Virgin Mobile on and you're gone.
Oh my God, that is too crazy. That is nuts. Right. Yeah, let me just go to my little parcel on the moon and I'll, set up shop. Right.
That's it.
I mean, kind of a brilliant business move in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he's making a lot of money off of the gimmick,
What a trip. I'll look into him. What's the how do you spell his last name?
It's just Dennis Hope, Hope.
Oh, Hope.
Yeah.
Nice name. I'm sure that ties into a few advertising little ideas.
Well, and I was
Hope.
thinking about songs too. That guy just has the perfect name to fall into a song. But I don't want to divert too far off with the Hope here.
No, that's great.
We'll come back down to Southern California. Talk to me about growing up in Southern California and what that environment was like to foster this love of jazz and music that you have.
Very good. I'm a I haven't counted, but definitely at least a couple generations native Californian. My dad and my, I guess that's three generations. My dad and my grandfather grew up here, as did my mom. My grandparents on my mom's side were from New York. A lot of family back east. All came west kind of in the 40s. But I grew up in a really kind of like just outside of Los Angeles, a rural a community. So I felt like in some ways it was this very idyllic, bucolic upbringing in this nice, beautiful, natural area. And I really never went into Los Angeles until I was in my, 13 or 14 years old, when my piano teacher that I was studying with at the time lived there. And I just had a wonderful upbringing with a Disney Imagineer. My dad was an Imagineer. So a lot of wonder for my brother and sister and I about, creativity, imagination, ride construction at the parks. He was involved with overseeing the installation of attractions. And I got very interested in the mechanics of all that, the process of seeing an idea germinate and get developed into its final completion. We were fascinated by the process, my siblings and I. At the same time, I was reading Ray Bradbury, started reading Douglas Adams. I was reading anything and anybody, Isaac Asimov, that was science and kind of fantasy, maybe more hard science, like Carl Sagan, not necessarily total science fiction, but I started falling in love with those authors. And my dad at the same time was showing me stuff like, all the great John Ford movies, Howard Hawks films, Alfred Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick. So I was getting a nice dose of art and interesting art and multidisciplinary art from the time I was 9 or 10 all the way into my 20s.
Cool.
And my grandfather, too, on my mom's side, he was a doctor in Long Beach, but he was also a classical pianist and quite well trained. So he inspired me through his music and shared his love of records, vinyl, of which I now today, probably think because of him, I collect vinyl and seek it out and love listening to it in that format. So I had some great role models in Southern California growing up in the 80s and 90s. And stayed local for school. I went to Long Beach State. I looked at other colleges around the U.S., but I was deciding I wanted to stay close to home and be with my grandma, who had just lost her husband, and be with her. And I continued to develop my voice in the Los Angeles area. And then I got a gig with Natalie Cole in 2008 and toured with her for 6 years, which was amazing. So I got to see the world with Natalie. And I was pleased as punch to get a touring gig from Los Angeles in jazz. Natalie's a jazz artist, but also, of course, has some R&B and other flavors in her music. But seems to me that there's few jazz tours leaving from L.A. as opposed to maybe New York. So that was a big thing for me when I was kind of getting ready to get out on the road. So
yeah.
It's kind of a nutshell. I've played trumpet from about 11 to age 20. I was in marching band. I was definitely like a band nerd, band nerd. But it fostered a great sense of community, and I never looked back. I loved music from the beginning, and I knew I wanted to make it my career, make it my voice. And growing up in that part of LA in the 80s and 90s, it was undeveloped. It felt like I was kind of just a boy on like a farm on my own. I mean, sometimes I liken it to the Midwest, though I go back now to this area and it's, of course, 20, 30 years later, it's all developed. Doesn't have as much of the charm as it did then, but everything moves on.
Yeah. Well, as a Midwestern guy, you're painting every possible visual growing up in the 80s from all the sets of Steven Spielberg films. So that's how we in the Midwest conceptualized, E.T., all these films. That was Southern California. It was like we had that bespeckled notion of just the grandeur of, California at that point.
Yeah. So, E.T. was filmed around the corner from our house.
Wow, see,
if that puts it into perspective, that's the city I grew up in.
Yeah, I must have just had a feeling.
That's crazy you said that.
Yeah, it's what I was thinking the entire time, because I,
right.
I love California. I've been out there a number of times, but I always think, when you're saying the 80s and kind of outside of L.A., that was Spielberg, that's what he did,
Right.
So
that is totally right, yep. There's a great, one more note. There's a great, if I find it, I'll send it to you, but there's a YouTube or documentary that was made about science fiction or, guys of the James Cameron, Steven Spielberg ilk, maybe even Ridley Scott is interviewed too. And then talking about those kind of geographical locations and why they're attracted to them and seeing some of their first 50s sci-fi movies and how they influenced their other films and growing up a kid, a lot of them grew up in the 50s and 60s when this all that science fiction stuff was brand new and it was really exciting. You might get a kick out of it. I'll look for it.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Yeah, yeah. I'd love. And I'm a big sci-fi person myself. I was just blown away by that presentation they had of the cosmos by Sagan. I mean, that was mind-blowing, that whole series.
Oh, isn't that great? That
oh, my God.
One. My goodness. I know the new one's great, too. I mean, I love Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The original one, Sagan was just like this weird guru. I mean, what an interesting guy.
Yeah, I mean, he took everything kind of in that Hawking way and condensed it down into these bite-sized morsels our brains could conceptualize, you know.
Good way to put it.
Yeah, the calendar of our existence, and you realize how unbelievably minute you feel so small when you're done watching all of that, you know.
Right.
So you played the trumpet till you were in your 20s. How did you land on the piano?
I started piano when I was 9. And was studying it all through the time I was playing trumpet. And trumpet was a great instrument for me because I love still picking it up and playing it now. And the breathing and the phrasing part of trumpet, I definitely use in my piano playing and my teaching about using your breath to think about phrasing at the piano, which a lot of pianists don't. But I decided to leave it and just focus on piano because it wasn't for me. The trumpet was too practice intensive and just another world of music that I didn't necessarily think I had enough of a voice in. But I really, you know, my grandfather being this, you know, classically trained player, I was just very in awe of the power and the prowess of the piano and the just the highs being so high and the lows low at the dynamic range, the orchestration possibilities. And it was attractive, and it's just still baffles me. The instrument is just like a universe to me, and it's never ceases to give me enough to practice or work on. And I love all the different shades that it's capable of. I never really became a keyboardist. I have a Nord. I had a Rhodes for a while. I do some keyboard stuff, but really my voice has morphed into this, you know, really just piano-driven sound, which it's been hard to explain to people sometimes. You know, someone calls for a gig, and they're like, oh, you don't play keyboard, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, nothing. I just don't prefer it.
Yeah.
You know, it's why a trumpet player doesn't necessarily play, I don't know, valve trombone or pocket trumpet. I mean, they have one instrument, that's their voice. And, you know, you can cite many, many people over the decades that, you know, when faced with a synth or a piano, they always took piano or they always went with the synth. And so piano just became the center of my world, and I wanted to make sure it was front and center, and it has been and hopefully continue to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I always am amazed when I talk to a whole breadth of jazz musicians, from those that are legends and luminaries all the way down to beginners. The piano is always kind of the starting point for a song or for an idea. You know, it's gonna be Mingus was the bass guy, but he had a piano around when he wanted to start getting the tunes down. So it's always amazing to me how that works.
It is. Yeah. It's like the seed. It's somehow ground zero, or it's like the zero, you know, theorem. Ridley Scott reference. There's something about it. I don't know. It's like O negative blood or something, you know.
Right.
It's like a source. And it's been like that for so long. I mean, there's something to be said about it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Duke, you know, my favorite musical personalities played it. Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Hank Jones, Tommy Flanagan, Mulgrew Miller, Herbie. I mean, these are guys that the piano is just an extension of them to me. Like, I just feel like music is oozing out of them in every way. So, I don't know. I'm really attracted to people that decide that the piano is their voice. And even, of course, today, like Modern Cats, who are, you know, Mel Dow and all the guys in New York who are doing their thing. It's wonderful. And I love everyone's individual sound on the piano. It's so cool. It's the same instrument that someone sits down at, and then the next guy comes and sits down at, can be sound so different and so fresh.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Well, and this new kid, Joey Alexander, who's 11, who just released that album, it's crazy to watch him on the keys, just taken it over.
Yeah, I know. Everyone's talking about it. My God, I was talking to my buddy up, Mauro Ruiz, great pianist in L.A., and he was like, yeah, Joey Alexander, he sounds great. He's like, well, people stop posting that clip to my Facebook page, please.
Yeah.
All his friends who are like, oh, you get a kick out of this kid. It's like, he's everywhere right now. But it's quite remarkable to see, I'm sure you thought of this, such a young voice with such a mature touch and sound. I mean, at 11 years old, I've never heard of anybody that young. I mean, he's like a little Mozart.
Incredible
soul.
Yeah, totally.
Exactly. It's like trapped in a young person's body. It's bizarre.
Yep, it is. Totally.
Reincarnated or something. It's captivating.
Yeah. Could be. Totally could be. Could be some spectral residue of Monk that just stayed around. Just went right into this kid, you know.
You know, he kind of reminds me of, do you know who Michele Petrucciani was? You probably do.
Yeah.
He kind of reminds me of, just because he's short and just like big hands and like super focused when he plays. It just kind of reminds me of that energy that Michele had.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So on your path to piano, you studied with Cecilia Coleman at Long Beach State. What was that experience like for you?
Wonderful. Cecilia was my main inspiring teacher. I started with her for, 4 or 5 years, I guess. And she taught me about, actually, all those pianists that I mentioned to you. I started learning their music, you know, Mulgrew and Kenny Bear and Herbie. And she didn't let it sit there. She moved it out to Horn. So I learned, you know, about Dexter Gordon and Sonny Stitt, Sonny Rollins. She had a really kind of complete view of jazz. And to this day, she's one of my favorite artists. She's been living in New York for, I think she moved there in 98 while I was still in school at Long Beach State. So she's been there for 17 years.
Cool.
And she also put a nice emphasis on writing, composition, arranging, of which I've adopted with my own teaching, because it's such an important part of the jazz voice to me, to bring out that original sound in whatever you're doing. And I learned about horn writing with her and, band leading, arranging. I went to a lot of her gigs and watched her lead and asked certain musicians to be part of her music because she liked their sound, and write music to the certain musicians because of she knew their strengths and weaknesses. And she really is a complete musician, a band leader, and got an amazing ear and taught me to learn to use my ear instead of the fake book, you know, open a fake book and let's learn the tune that way.
Right.
You know, she really was stressed learning it off a record and just letting your ear do the work, and that it gets easier every time you do it when you do it that way.
Yeah.
So I highly value my time with Cecilia. And, you know, where some people go, oh, why didn't you go to music conservatory or, you know, somewhere a little bit more prestigious, or you could have studied with anybody. Well, at the time, Joe, I was 18.
Yeah,
I thought I knew about jazz. I didn't know crap. I was an enthusiast about the music. I hadn't really studied it, the pedagogy, the art form that much. So Cecilia, for me, was a great place to start because she was local. She was kind of a hard-driving person in the beginning, kind of get me to a place where she could work with me. It was a cheaper education. You know, I got scholarships all on the way, so I never got any debt, which I really am happy about, because a lot of friends of mine now have debt, even for bachelor's degrees, you know, of course, like for music degree, which is almost just poison because of, you know, how hard that is. Anyway, no judgment on that. It's just everyone makes their own decisions, but I was really happy to take care of my grandma. She lived right across the street from Long Beach State, actually, so I walked to school. And got to hang with Cecilia and go to her house, and it was a really nice time with her. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Very cool. So let's talk a little bit about kind of your trajectory in your career. You're doing a lot of work for TV and film. Is that something that was premeditated? What's kind of been your methodology or your philosophy on getting into that realm?
Yeah, it's something I love. I'm a movie fanatic, especially older, you know, American films from the 30s through the 60s, 70s. And I've been wanting to get into scoring more and more, you know, as every year goes by. Tough nut to crack in Los Angeles because there's, you know, a boatload of people that are trying to do that and have, you know, more training, more qualifications, more, you know, they're not a jazz player that's trying to, you know, foray into film writing. So it's pretty minimal what I've done so far, Joe. I've only scored maybe three or four short films, a handful of two or three documentaries, all cable or, you know, and then some of my music's been placed, you know, like a music that's already written. So something from Discoveries, for instance, made it into a science show, or I wrote a scene for Johnson & Johnson national TV commercial. Cool. Someone that's done some of the same stuff is Larry Goldings, who I'm quite close with. And he loves film and loves the link between jazz and, you know, the cinema. And we both would like to do more of that. Like, you know, it's, like I said, it's tough nut to crack because it's quite competitive. So trajectory-wise, well, you know, jazz is my focus, and original music, making records, whatever the content might be. But I do want to score more and be in that world. Not necessarily only do that, because I have, of course, some friends that tell you the horror stories of the late night scoring sessions and deadlines, and you know, bringing me back to reality when I'm like, oh, I want to do this, and they're like, okay, maybe, but just let me tell you how it really is. You know,
yeah,
you have zero budget, you have a deadline, they don't like this, you got to change it quick. You know, other factors and demanding schedule stuff. So it's the allure, it's the, I guess, the idyllic idea of scoring films that I'm in love with, maybe not the practical realities of it.
Right.
So I'm open. Really open. You know, if someone came along and said, hey, can you score my short film? I have, you know, $500, but I want you to do whatever you want. Like, that actually happened with a film I did a couple years ago. It was a jazz kind of story, and it was perfect. It was totally up my alley, and as far as subject matter, you know, it was set in 1959, so mild, you know, kind of blue and Giant Steps and Blowing the Blues Away and all these great jazz albums that came out that year became the director's touchstone for all my music. So it was like, oh, this is perfect. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
When directors come to you with a clear vision of, they've done some of their homework, and then go, well, here's what I've found that works, and what do you think? So that was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm kind of willing to go wherever the wind blows with that stuff. I'm not really interested in some of the more grunt oriented, like arranging and copy work that a lot of guys do in Los Angeles to assist some of the bigger film composers. But I know I've heard it's, you know, of course, a stepping stone to getting your own thing, or to getting visibility, or, you know, just getting out there.
Sure.
So, yeah, another world that I'm, you know, happy to touch just a little bit.
So speaking of another world, you've been, at this point in your mid to late 30s, you played with Natalie Cole, Anthony Wilson, Peter Erskine, you know, the list goes on. What has it been like to hop on a stage with people that have that much mileage behind their rearview mirror, and to feel that energy in the crowd? And is it an experience for you? What has that been like?
Thrilling. I mean, probably of the people you mentioned, the most visibility, of course, the most seasoned artist who's toured the world as a solo artist, known to more people, is Natalie. I just think about the first time I played with her and looked up at the screen when they do the video for Unforgettable that she sings with her dad. And I felt like I was on stage with Nat. It was bizarre. I was like, looking into Natalie's eyes, I felt like I was looking into Nat King Cole's eyes. And vice versa, you know, like I just felt like I was looking into this lineage of greatness. Thrilling, because I had never played to, you know, I played the Hollywood Bowl with her twice, and that's 17,000 people. That was absolutely thrilling. I did three nights at the Sydney Opera House with her, with the Sydney Symphony. One of the highlights of my career, and to hear the full orchestra, you know, with all those great arrangements by Johnny Mandel and Alan Broadbent and Patrick Williams, and all this just lush strings surrounding you in this wonderful venue, and everyone's there to be a part of it. Nothing like it. With an artist like Anthony Wilson, I haven't really performed in big venues with him, but I'm on his new record, which is due out soon, which is really a really fun crossover, definitely like more rock-oriented jazz record. And when I play with him, more club dates usually, but he's one of these ever-expanding musicians that dreams big, is a total improviser, loves being in the moment, loves surrounding himself with really talented guys, and challenges himself to write. He writes all the time. He's a wonderful writer, from all his guitar quartet music to his nonet music. Of course, he tours with Diana Krall, so that's some of his bread and butter there, which he enjoys. But I love his vision. Anthony is one of my absolute total favorite people.
Sure.
Person. And then Sarah Gazarek, who I've been with for 11 years now, we have a different musical journey. She and I have collaborated on writing and arranging for a long time and made, let's see, about 5 records together. And Sarah's trajectory is a little bit like a slower climb, but she's a really great artist. And we're going to go to Japan in a couple months. Our duo record is coming out. It's just her and I, and it's coming out in Japan. It'll be out in June. I'm not sure when it's out in the States. I'm not sure really what's going on with that right now. But she performs in smaller venues and some larger ones. And she's an artist to watch and continues to grow and find interesting new material to draw from. Another person that I've been really loving playing with in the last couple of years is this incredible accordionist from Paris, France, named Richard Galliano.
Yeah.
Who's just one of a kind, and effortless mastery, to quote Kenny Werner, is like the way I can describe him. He's just, music's just pouring out of this guy. And I've played in New York with him a few times. I'm going to New York in June to play with him at Dizzy's for a few nights. And just, yeah, limitless. And I love him. And I saw him play in France in this gorgeous old cathedral. And people were just mesmerized by him. He combines classical and jazz, and just very unique artist.
Yeah.
So that's somebody that I'm like thrilled to get to play with occasionally.
You know, the beauty of the music is that there's a sound that everybody has. There's a sound you have and everybody else that's established in the jazz craft. That's one thing, but what message, what are you trying to say with your music?
I'm trying to tell a story. Mm-hmm. The records are a testament to that, starting with my first one. I mean, the real first one that came out was Let It Go back in 2006.
Yeah.
And it was a story of letting go. I was going through a rough time in my life, and I have some negative feelings about how the record was recorded and some certain elements that I didn't feel it went as well as it could, but you live, you learn. It was a story I put out. It was a collection of tunes I wrote specifically to work together. And then the story theme was, you know, further developed for me with I Hear Rhapsody, which was the next record. And that was about songs that were pulling me out back into my life and getting back to being positive and making music with friends. And then Discoveries and Exploring Mars, of course, you know, we've talked about those themes. So tell a story and invite the audience in. I love when melodies are really accessible and not overly complicated, even if they are technically hard to execute from a musician's standpoint. I want listeners to be moved by the energy and the memorability of melody. I want them to be able to leave a show of mine and be singing something or yeah. wanting to hear it again. So many times I leave jazz shows and I can't sing anything I'm leaving. I guess that's probably some of in Simi Valley, where I grew up, that I was in a local community theater my parents were involved in. And I learned from an early age how important it is to connect with the audience and don't leave them in the dust. Involve them in the process. Ask them what they liked, ask them what they didn't like. Be really present with them all the time. So I feel like that's translated into the sound of like some of these records and the direction. And, you know, like going back to my roots with my dad being a Disney Imagineer, that themed idea, you know, that kind of almost comic book like approach to the records, where there's a serious artwork factor too. Like you can look at the record and go, oh, someone painted this picture for this and was inspired by this and contributed their art form to this. And that's what I want to do with the Live Discovery Project, which is bring other artists in so we all collaborate together to produce something beautiful, right? Because I also realize I can't do it myself.
Yeah.
Jazz and any creative art form relies on other people to help make it sound the way it does. And I feel like all the guys that play on my records, especially the last couple, they're composing parts for, you know, the drums, for the bass. Like, this is how this goes with this piece. And while it might not necessarily be written out, which just we just have a lead sheet or a score, I love that they've crafted a part to my music, and that's what people hear and that's what people remember. Even some students have learned, like a couple students have learned some of those arrangements or original tunes, and they want to get the drum part just like it was played, like on the record. And I just love that. I just think it's neat to try and, as a student, like nail, because I remember doing the same thing, like just nail what a, you know, your favorite drummer, your favorite piano was doing and cop that feel, could get that energy. So, you know, I guess all in all, just not alienate audiences, invite them in, tell a story, have some good melodies happen that linger in the air. That's my goal on the team.
Right on.
Well, it's worked for you. You've won some awards over the years, the Louis Armstrong Award, the John Philip Sosa Award.
Yes, high school.
So all of those were in high school?
No. Louis Armstrong and John Philip Sosa were both in high school when I was trumpet and piano. The Hmong competition I was in 2006 as a semifinalist. There were some scholarships I got while I was in college, big ones, this big Tom Talbert. It was like a $10,000 scholarship. And I'm constantly entering songwriting competitions to try and just get noticed and get a little extra bread here and there. But there's one that hopefully, you know, this we'll see if it place in anything. But, you know, just putting the music out there. That's all I really care about. I don't, you know, the accolades are great, but I don't think very close yet to a Grammy nomination, though I did make a first round of Grammy nods for another big band record, and I was nominated for a solo. But I've never been a competition guy. I've like, you know, a lot of cats are like, oh, let me try for this competition. I'm kind of not confrontational that way, and I'd just rather make the music with my friends. And I've always been kind of anti-competition, just because I think jazz competition is just that, even that phrase is just an oxymoron. I mean, it's such a subjective thing, you know, what's good, bad, who's better than somebody else, you know.
Well, let's go from the awards to something more elemental. Tell me what the greatest thing is about waking up every day.
The greatest thing, what? Sorry?
The greatest thing about waking up every day.
Nice. Good question. Oh, man. another chance to get to be at the piano, another chance to get out in nature. I love hiking and jogging and getting musical ideas outside of the piano. For me, putting on a record at home, a new piece of vinyl I found or an old piece of vinyl, or going to a shop and looking for vinyl. Yeah, all those are things that I really look forward to when I get up every day. Making an impact with the music, teaching. I love teaching and imparting some of the knowledge to students and watching them grow. I get really excited about seeing the growth in young students, and so seeing them getting excited about music is absolutely thrilling. So I'd say those are the top things for me. Film, of course. Like today I'm going to go see a screening of Double Indemnity, the Billy Wilder film from the 40s.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something I really get a kick out of. So I got up today going, yes, I got to see one of my favorite Barbara Stanwyck, Fred McMurray movies.
Cool. Very cool. Well, yeah. Since we kind of got on that whole Spielberg kind of Zemeckis kind of line of movie nostalgia, I'm going to stay on that. And I'm going to present you with the scenario of you walk out of one of your gigs and you got the DeLorean sitting right there and you can punch the keys to any place in history and watch a jazz show. Where are you going to go?
Wow. You know what? My first one that came to my mind, man, I'd probably go to the 1964 Sonny Valentine Miles concert.
Yeah.
Just because it's that era of Miles where the quintet was just like morphing and changing, and Tony Williams was young and fiery, and every time I put that record on, it's just that energy. You could feel it. I mean, I feel like just what a moment in jazz history where you can hear the history of the music and you can hear all the forward thinking in the music all kind of coming together. I can't think of another like moment, like a live moment like that from that era. There's another Joe Henderson record, and I think it's probably from just a little earlier, maybe around the same time, 65, 66. It's live in Paris called Four with Wynton Kelly and Jimmy Cobb and who's on bass? I'm forgetting. Anyway, and it's just the energy. I mean, just to be somewhere in the mid-60s, like in New York or Paris or something, seeing these guys at the top of their game. I mean, especially Miles or Coltrane or Joe Henderson, or I mean, that would have just been absolutely thrilling. And also with the Miles Funny Valentine concert, not only being able to see Miles, but young Herbie Hancock, young Anthony Wilson, I mean, Anthony Williams, Ron Carter, George Coleman, you know, all these guys that were just brand new, getting their ideas flowing. I mean, gosh, that would probably be my first reaction. I'd have to think if there's any others, but yeah, 60s.
Yeah, that'd be cool. That'd be very cool. So let me ask you this. We hooked up here in about 10, 15 years. We talk again. And I start our interview off with,
Oh, sorry. Can you start again? My phone set came out. One more time with that question.
No, that's cool. So let's say we hook up in 10 or 15 years to catch up with what's been going on with you. What's going to be the first kind of couple things that you're going to want to tell me, man, this happened?
I would say, ooh, that's good. I scored my first full orchestral movie with a full orchestra.
Right on.
That would be cool. I would love it. And if it's, you know, has a little space, time travel, Mars stuff in it, that would be even better. or a new record, or a new way of performing with the Discovery Project, like some kind of extension of it where there's some performance art involved, or a new technology that I'm able to incorporate that somehow enhances the project in a really different and engaging way for the artists and the audience. Those come to mind. Yeah, the scoring thing for sure. Like, you know, me standing in front of an orchestra on the scoring stage, hearing my music, that would be really cool. And further endeavors and the developments with the audio-visual multimedia thing.
Cool. Yeah. So let's say a fan leaves the show and they're really, really keyed up on who you are after hearing your music, and they come home and they Google your name. If you could have the ideal, like, sentence or three sentences about who you are to kind of capture the essence of who you are in word, what would that be?
You said two or three sentences.
Well, yeah, I sometimes I pose this as, tell me who you are to tweet, but I'm going to give just a little bit more latitude with this, just to kind of figure out who you are. What would you like to see come up that would kind of back up the music they heard to kind of let them know who you are?
Multidisciplinary, innovator Josh Nelson explores different themes with his different albums and is presenting new and interesting immersive audience opportunities for live listeners, but also has a love for, film scores and cinema and science and brings that into everything he does. You know, I think that'd probably be the closest, at least today, what I would say that I would hope would come up when someone Googles me, because while I love being identified as a jazz pianist, I want to be known as an artist that is thinking about other things and bringing them in to collaborate with jazz and to intermingle and to continue to help move the art form forward.
The one thing that I would request that you would add as an addendum as the author of the album Exploring Mars is to say you grew up in the neighborhood around where E.T. came in to the world. That'd be kind of cool.
I know, right?
All right, man. Hey, Josh, thanks, man. I'll let you get back to it, and take it easy.
Man, great to talk to you, Joe. Great questions.
Absolutely. Thank you, man.
Okay, take care.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, California, and spots all over America giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Josh Nelson for his time, creativity, and cool jazz music, baby. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.